Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the use of history and memory in Russia by the Kremlin, and in particular, its use in the war against Ukraine. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Dr. Alison Edwards, a lecturer at Bath Spa University in the UK, and an expert on Russian militarism, youth, memory, and patriotic education. Thank you very much for joining me, Alison.
And thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you on the show again. It's been over a year. Now, I've watched, I think last time we spoke was around May 9th last year. Now, I've watched Russia's Victory Day ceremonies for many years now, sometimes in Moscow. Obviously, the annual parade marking the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. And one thing I've noticed is that Russian President Vladimir Putin seems to have increasingly over the years suggested that the United States and the West, of course, allies of the USSR in World War II, now pose a threat that is similar to the one posed to Europe and the world and Russia by Nazi Germany. As you and a colleague noted in a recent article in The Conversation, Putin now presents the Soviet Union's existential struggle against Nazi Germany, unjustifiably, as the equivalent of Russia's war in Ukraine. I mean, in fact, I would say Ukraine's war is existential. Its defensive war is existential. It's defending its existence, while Russia's existence is not threatened and was not when Putin launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. In the same article, you also wrote that Putin, quote, manipulates certain moments in history to justify both his claims that Russia is a great power and his foreign policy actions, unquote. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on Russia's use or abuse of history, maybe the history of Ukraine and the history of World War II, as he pursues this effort to subjugate Ukraine by force.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much for that kind of opening statement, particularly the piece that you're referring to, the conversation piece, the one that's authored by myself, but also my colleague at Aberystwyth University, Jenny Mathers. And one of the things that we have been focusing on is the use and abuse of history, but particularly for a youth audience. But I think let's first of all kind of talk about that, the way in which the history of World War II has been used to frame the history of the war in Ukraine, which you've noted there. I think the use of the Great Patriotic War as a war that defines what's happening in the present in Russia is certainly not a new thing. It has been used in the past to discuss, for example, issues that have arisen in foreign policy in the 1990s, for example, in 1990s Russia. And so the Great Patriotic War was used, or at least came into a public framing again and again, and has been, particularly during times of chaos, and the 1990s in itself has been called and classed the Wild 90s. So it's worked in that sense. So it's definitely something that's not new, and I think that's why it has also become an important point of the Kremlin in today's world, because it's already ingrained so much in Russian society. It, for example, takes up the annual commemorative calendar in Russia. So every 9th of May, there is a huge military procession that we see on Red Square, but also, I mean, not in the last couple of years, but usually they would also have it in the different regions as well. They would have their own kind of Victory Day parade. But also there are events that happen in Russia leading up to the anniversary. You'll have kind of concerts taking place. You'll have You'll have concerts, you'll have like key meetings taking place in the Kremlin, you'll have schools doing or being brought in to do things and do activities, and basically anything to celebrate the Great Patriotic War. And when I was in Russia myself, when I was in Russia before the May parade in 2019, even like 2-3 weeks before, preparations were already taking place. So you could see the kind of annual commemorative calendar of the Great Patriotic War taking place, when, or at least happening outside the realms of 9th of May. So it's already ingrained in society. So it's a really easy history to pick if you are someone working in the Kremlin. At the same time, it's got a high level of social acceptability, because even though it's an easy history to pick out, to focus on, it wasn't an easy history for those people who lived it. 27 million Soviet people died as a result of the Great Patriotic War. So there are families in Russia today where at least one person in their family was touched by or impacted somehow by the war itself. So it's one of those that is used or at least mobilized by the Kremlin because it has this high level of kind of emotion attached to it. And one of the questions that kind of me and Jenny ask often is, would it have the same effect? Would Putin's justification for war in Ukraine have the same effect if it wasn't for the use and mobilization of that Great Patriotic War as kind of a sticking point? So the way in which it's been used is almost as a kind of a way to bridge the past and present. So what you'll see, for example, in speeches, particularly around the 9th of May, is this note that the younger generations and current Russian military cohorts are continuing the victory of those ancestors before them. They're kind of framed, for example, as the greatest generation and a generation that you want to emulate. And this is the idea that you want to emulate those who fought in the Great Patriotic War, again, is not new, but in recent years, particularly since 2014, so since Russia's legal annexation of Crimea. The war in Ukraine has been defined as something in which people in Russia are kind of continuing the victory of those before them. But I mean, even just in more recent speeches, so the Victory Day that's just happened now, it's less about the youth showing gratitude, or not just youth, but people in Russia showing gratitude towards the veterans. I mean, that's still a core part of it, but it's kind of changed now. So in Putin's speech, for example, it wasn't just about the people in Russia glorifying those veterans, but actually there was a shift. So in Putin's speech, he said, our veterans believe in and care for you. And so the bridge that usually was one way from everyone in Russia to the veterans has kind of become two way now, because the veterans themselves have been placed as those who are kind of showing their own gratitude for those who are currently fighting in Ukraine, which I thought was really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. But even in Putin's speech on the 9th of May, you can see that kind of binding of the past and present by saying that the veteran spiritual involvement is in the destinies and exploits of those current Russians who are fighting in Ukraine today, and that current kind of sacrifice has taken place inextricably binds the generations of heroes together. That's kind of, I'm paraphrasing, of course, his speech. Mm-hmm. But I think kind of the final thing I want to kind of note on this is that the Great Patriotic War is being used specifically for Ukraine. However, it's also speaking to this kind of existential war that Russia sees itself having with the West, with Ukraine almost acting as a kind of a frontier for that war. Because what you'll see in the everyday is when Russia's speaking about this war, it's not just talking about Ukraine, but also talking about the West. And when they mention they, they're usually referring to the West being against them. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of use and abuse of history, and particularly World War II, and it has its value in Russia in that it's a very important past. But I also think the further we get away from that, the Kremlin is now starting to kind of change the narrative slightly so that we can bring the focus or justification for the war in Ukraine to what's happening actually, the victories of the people who are currently in Russia, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I have a follow-up question. it's obviously a kind of acrobatic trick for Putin to kind of link World War II with the war with Russia's war against Ukraine, and to present the West as kind of the threat, as a threat on par with Nazi Germany. You know, the whole, I mean, just sort of the basic fact is that the Soviet Union and United States and Britain and France were allies in World War II, and now, you know, somehow it's being turned into, you know, this is the new war for Russia's existence. And as you certainly rightly said, Putin, you know, and others in the government are presenting the war in Ukraine as, which they're still calling it mostly a special military operation, you know, as part of a larger war, kind of existential or civilizational conflict against the West, and a defensive one. But so my question, I guess, is, and it's obviously hard without being there, but, you know, do you think that on the whole, the, you know, Russians who are sort of buying this this kind of link between World War II and the war against Ukraine, or is it something that they sort of shrug off, you know, as just propaganda?
I mean, there will certainly be people in Russia who will kind of shrug it off as propaganda. Of course, it's just that those people won't be voicing that because of the legal structures that have been brought into place since the war reignited in 2022. What I would say, however, is that, and this is actually a discussion that I've been having kind of very early on since the war with kind of other colleagues as well, is about how, while we might look at this story and think, oh, yeah, how on earth can people believe how can people buy into this? It's a very... I'm trying to think of the phrase for this, but it's a very, I can imagine it's a very believable or familiar story with right. people in Russia. And not because, I'm one of those people who's looking at that and thinking, like, how on earth can you believe in this? But at the same time, you know, I've surveyed textbooks, for example, in schools. I've surveyed in how history has been used kind of earlier on in the 1990s. And it's lots of the educational textbooks, for example, will feature a high level of military history in Russia's history and in the Soviet history. So, yes, we're talking about kind of the Great Patriotic War here. But, like, for example, if you looked at Russian history from further back, a lot of the pages of textbooks are also taken also speak about the Swedish War. Mm-hmm. The Russian-Swedish War. We'll also talk about Russian-Turkish War, in which actually they lay a lot of blame on Britain at the time for pushing Turkey into a war with Russia. Or, like, that's kind of the claims that are being made in the textbooks.
Right.
But also there's a lot kind of dedicated to, not so much in the 1990s, but also towards NATO. And a lot of these narratives, so the Swedish history, for example, or like Turkish wars, they are very much... stuck within the textbooks, I would say, more than in the everyday and kind of commemorative landscape. But then you've also got the other story here then of NATO in the everyday Russian landscape and how NATO's talked about, for example, as this like age-old enemy against the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but also now of the Russian people. And so when there's so many different narratives going around in the Russian kind of communication space, whether it's through formal education or just more broadly, you know, there's museum exhibitions, for example, called NATOism, mm-hmm. which brings together NATO, history of NATO, and Nazism. Uh-huh. So that, you know, it's more so than just in kind of educational textbooks. What starts to happen is this very convincing story about this besieged fortress, this world, this dangerous world that Russia is vulnerable to, starts to formulate. And so it's very easy for us kind of on the outside to think, well, how on earth could this be convincing? But when we start to look at the narratives that are implemented within the everyday, and when these narratives and discourses are not just taking place in one sector like education, but also in kind of cultural activities, in political speeches, in newspapers, it starts to become convincing. So something that you can come to believe. So I think that actually when we talk about World War II, if let's say we talk specifically about World War II, Putin has in recent years, particularly in his speeches, talked about how the Soviet Union, and he uses the phrase, like, bore the brunt of the Second World War. So, you know, yes, America was allies at the time, but actually they left a lot of the Second World War, and particularly the frontier in Stalingrad, to the Soviet Union. That's the phrase that they, that that's this kind of story that they're telling at these commemorative events. But then at the same time, there's also other stories taking place, you know, how even before then, Russia has been in a cycle of wars that have come from the West where Russia has been vulnerable, or NATO during the Cold War, for example. So if you see all of these things coming together, even though the Great Patriotic War takes up a vast majority of Russia's education and communication space beyond education, you start to see that there are different threads of this besieged fortress mentality in which Russia is the besieged fortress. That's the narration that's being promoted by the Kremlin and by other societal domains. You can see that actually this could be quite convincing to someone who isn't being able to access the internet, who isn't kind of trying to ask critical questions about the history that they're being told, or maybe because they haven't had the opportunity to ask these critical questions.
Absolutely. That's a great point about, I guess, you know, the World War II is almost an anomaly, you know, in between the, I guess, confrontations, you know, with Sweden or with other Western powers in the past, and then, you know, the tension with NATO after World War II in the Cold War. And also you mentioned kind of the idea that which is certainly played up, you know, Soviet Union, you know, did bear the brunt, but also, you know, I think there's a wide view and fed by propaganda in part, you know, that people in Russia say, you know, some people in Russia say, well, the U.S. only decided to, you know, to get involved when they understood who was going to win. So, I mean, those are kind of all part of the narrative. So I agree. I mean, when you sort of see that as a whole, it's probably more convincing to many Russians. So thanks very much for that. Now, you've also studied the role of children in all this, the way the Kremlin uses young people as part of its messaging, and I guess its myth-making about the past. Perhaps most of all, when it comes to World War II, but also children and young people as instruments to shape the future. In the article, in the conversation, you and Jenny Mathers, you mentioned, wrote that, quote, Putin and his supporters are preparing the next generation of Russian citizens to regard war as a normal and necessary condition of Russia's existence, unquote. Now, people watching Russia in recent years have remarked about how it seems Putin is not just preparing for a long war, but maybe relying on the war against Ukraine to maintain his grip on power for as long as possible. Allison, I wonder if you could talk about the role the Kremlin seems to have in mind for children and young people as part of these efforts.
Great question. And I think you know, Putin is definitely wanting to maintain his grip on power. But I also, I'm believing here, particularly when focusing on the youth, that there's a trajectory here in which a longer war could be pursued. Of course, I think that the children are really central to the Kremlin and to Putin, the Putin regime in general. He's been focusing on patriotic education initiatives since 2001, and he's certainly not the first leader to engage in the youth to think about, in terms of like passing on particular ideologies, and also to be active participants in political initiatives that they've brought forward in the past. And if we're going to talk about ideology here, or at least what I am anyway, because I just mentioned it, I would say that militarism itself has become an ideology within the Russian state. And I think it's existed, again, beyond Putin himself. But it has become kind of a main identifier now. And so militarism itself, you'll see that kind of implanted Again, across the educational sector, but also beyond it, so in other societal domains as well. When it comes to the youth, a lot of people ask me, you know, what does a post-Putin Russia look like? And it's really interesting because it's usually the people who really don't give a voice to what's happening with youth in Russia today. And I think, well, just look at the youth. You know, look what is happening in the education system formally, but also look at what's happening in the education system beyond that. So, you know, me and Jenny, we look at youth patriotic military groups. But we're also sharing with each other different things that happen in the everyday for young people. So new films that are coming out about people of the past, like Suvorov, for example. That was a film that came out in 2022, and how, you know, in Suvorov's film, it wasn't necessarily about the general, Suvorov, who was a general of Russia during the Napoleonic Wars, but actually was about a boy called Grisha who supported and who actually saved he saved Suvorov in this story. Mm-hmm. And the storyline essentially was that anyone can be a hero, which is the main narrative that the Kremlin wants to impart on the young people of Russia today. What they want is to show that ordinary action can lead to extraordinary results. So like in the Second World War, where the everyday Soviet person participated and therefore did something that they deem heroic. They really want to highlight that to the young people. They don't just have to be nobles, or they don't just have to be kind of highly educated or rich people in order to kind of perform heroic acts. But what they deem as a heroic act is something that happens within a military framing. So the youth, for example, can do something that's in support of the military because they can't yet go to war because they're not of age, but they can do something in support of the military. And even by doing that, they are becoming a hero in themselves. So a lot of the youth, me and kind of Jenny are trying to conceptualize, well, what's the youth look like in Russia today? And we say, well, a lot of them look like rear workers, you know, home front workers, mm-hmm. because they're preparing care packages, they're writing letters to the soldiers on the front, but they're also doing other things like engaging with veterans as a way to preserve their memory and to glorify them and to share that memory and the memory of the Second World War with other people in Russia today to ensure that the memory stays kind of alive. The other thing that they are doing is they are, I'm kind of going to quote this, they are saving history. They are kind of promoting historical truth, and they are defending Russia from historical falsification. And these quotes that history is being falsified is usually kind of the West is doing it. The West is falsifying this history. And so the youth have been tasked to promote, perpetuate, to highlight the truthful version of the past in which the Soviet Union was victorious and everything else that went wrong, everything else that was bad at the time. So Katyn massacre, for example, collectivization under Stalin, those are things that are kind of pushed to the side. We don't talk about it. We don't talk about Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, for example. We're just talking about the Soviet victory. The one thing that me and Jenny kind of focus on that's really important to us is not just how these narratives, not just what narratives are imparted on the youth, so this idea that there is a one truth for the Second World War and you should promote it, but the way in which the youth are engaged in these activities. So it's not just sitting in a class and looking at a textbook or doing presentations or doing assessments, but it's about the feelings and emotions. So they act, they participate, for example, in activities that that engage them in an immersive experience of learning history, in which they're not just, as I said, reading the textbook, but they're being a part of that history. So whether it's through like watching Suvorov's Great Journey, that's the title of the film, or whether it's by participating in video games, or whether it's actually having the one-to-one direct conversations with veterans where they not just hear the stories, but they feel the emotion that the person is also kind of communicating whilst they're also talking about their story. It's very much, it's about trying to engage the youth on a deeper level. So through that emotion, through that feeling, through that embodiment of different kind of practices that we're really interested in. And so we see that immersive activity and that the deepening of not just knowledge of the Second World War, but also the feelings of the people who were part of it as the way in which the youth, not the youth, the Kremlin is trying to engage the youth and to make the youth feel about the military, the glory around the military, the excitement around the military, and how that then kind of normalizes it, but also gets people excited about the military and maybe potentially participating in the military in the future.
Thanks. That's I would say fascinating, but chilling. Just one kind of follow up question. And I think you mentioned at the beginning of our talk that you know, obviously celebration of the World War II victory is certainly not new in Russia. You know, in post-Soviet Russia, it was happening in the 90s. But how new is this? Are these phenomena that you're talking about with young people, children, and youth? Are these kind of immersive things and this real push, is that happening since the start of the full scale invasion of Ukraine, or does that go back further?
It definitely goes back further, because, you know, students have been performing in like war reenactments and things like that for a long time. They've been going to camps and learning about this. What I would say, however, is that, you know, as technology has gotten better, that's where we see an even deeper engagement. So I'm just going to take one step back and say the veteran one-to-one experiences have been taking place for a long, long time. So they are certainly not new. But as we move away from the Great Patriotic War and there are less veterans who fought in the war who are alive, the Kremlin has expanded what it means to be a veteran. And so youth now are not just engaging with the veterans who are still alive, but also with the children of the war, for example. So people who were just simply alive during the Second World War, so that they can share and impart their experiences and maybe share kind of the experiences of what their parents went through at the time as well with youth. So that's the kind of first thing. But those one-to-one interactions have been going on for a long time. And I would say definitely other things like war reenactments as well have been taking place for a while. I would say that as technology has gotten better, so with the kind of building of kind of video games, but also ones that could be virtual reality, I would say things like that are the new ways in which youth are engaging with war and values around the military. So that they feel like they themselves are kind of fighting on the front, if that makes sense. And so I'd say that technology has certainly had a big impact here, not just on them engaging in the topic itself, but then being able to feel emotions because they're actually stepping into the foot of whatever character they're playing in this video game.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks very much, Allison. And we're going to wrap it up here. I appreciate your comments. Thanks for joining me, Allison.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. My pleasure. Once again, I've been speaking to Dr. Allison Edwards, a lecturer at Bath Spa University and an expert on Russian militarism, youth, memory, and patriotic education. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.